I'm Sean Corcoran. Welcome to The Point. This is the news roundup. We're going to discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with some of our region's leading journalists. And with me in our Woods Hole studio now is Chris Lindahl of the Cape Cod Times. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Sean.
Thanks for joining me. Sam Houghton is here from the Mashpee Enterprise as well. Hello,
morning.
Sam.
Morning, Sean.
We'll speak with Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times, Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ann Wood from the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. So lots of news to get caught up on from the week. Let's start with some news from today's Cape Cod Times about the Powassan virus, one of the tick-borne viruses, probably the most concerning tick-borne virus because it can kill you and there is no treatment. What do we know?
Yeah, so this is a virus that's been kind of slowly increasing in how many people it's infecting over the last few years. And we have data from the county that shows that two Cape men have died this year from the virus. And the state says that there's been at least three fatalities across the state.
I think those numbers are being reported this year, but they're from a few years back, I think.
Yeah.
Because it takes some reporting time for the state to kind of put that together. But I think they died this year, huh? Okay.
They did die this year. And so the symptoms, kind of an interesting thing. People can either be asymptomatic, and that has happened. There's been three people who have been bitten on the Cape this year that testing of the ticks showed that these ticks were infected by the Powassan virus, but the people bitten were asymptomatic. But those who do show symptoms, they can include dizziness, nausea, vomiting, fever, and the most severe, swelling of the brain. And like you said, there's no treatment except kind of supportive care for those who are sick enough to be hospitalized, just kind of, making them more comfortable, maybe medicating them so that they're more comfortable as they're riding out the illness. It's still extremely rare. There's only been 13 confirmed cases between 2013 and 2016 in Massachusetts.
Hmm. And do we know what towns these folks were from?
We don't have confirmation. The state kind of is protecting the privacy of these two individuals, but we do know that ticks in East Ham and Wellfleet that were found to have the virus, and that's the three cases that I mentioned that the people were asymptomatic.
I see. Yeah, the state holds on to some of that information. Sometimes it's kind of strange because you don't even have to, I don't know about the privacy issue since you don't have to identify their names, but I think folks would be interested in where they contracted the disease. Now, what about chronic Lyme? Also a story this week about chronic Lyme disease, which is a very controversial topic in itself, but folks around here who have had symptoms of Lyme disease over a period of time saying, we don't have any specialists here.
Yeah, chronic Lyme continues to be the greatest threat for those who are bit by deer ticks. Centers for Disease Control say that there's 300,000 new cases of Lyme each year. And in Massachusetts, Barnstable County has among the highest rates of Lyme, along with Nantucket and Dukes counties, which are actually the two highest rates of Lyme disease infection. So among the problems that people have, especially on the Cape, is there's no doctors who devote their practice full time to treating Lyme disease. And it's a really complex, complex disease to treat because even after the recommended course of initial antibiotics, which is kind of the idea being to rid the body of the virus, there's some lingering effects that can last. That's kind of a controversial, controversial the way that that's treated because the most common way is through long-term antibiotics, which the CDC actually says they don't recommend it because studies haven't shown that that actually has a better effect on treating chronic Lyme over a placebo.
Right. Yeah. And the long-term treatment with antibiotics for the Lyme bacteria is very controversial. And it's anecdotally, you have folks in that story going off to New York on a regular basis to find someone who will actually make those prescriptions.
That's right. It's a kind of a big endeavor to treat chronic Lyme. People have to go far away to seek that type of treatment. And another complication is that many of these doctors don't accept insurance, so they're often left with bills of up to $1,000 per visit just to get the care that they say is helping them in a lot of cases.
And some doctors will talk about how insurance companies will come down on them if they prescribe long-term antibiotics, so they tend to stay away from the insurance companies themselves. Let's say hello to Sam Houghton of the Mashpee Enterprise. Sam, you have a story this week, or there's a story in the Enterprise this week, about the Mashpee Housing Authority trying to tackle affordable housing. It's an issue across the Cape. It's a big issue in Mashpee.
Yeah, I think if you've been a reporter here for any length of time, or grew up here, you really know how bad it is. I think in Mashpee they have 5% affordable housing, compared to the market mandate from the state is 10%. But we heard the pitch from the Mashpee Housing Authority this week for a proposal. It seems kind of interesting. They are looking to use CPC or Community Preservation Act funding to put a down payment on houses throughout the community. Mrs. Leela Botsford, she's the executive director of the Housing Authority. She made the pitch to the CPC, and she's requesting about $400,000, and she's hoping to put a down payment on about 3 homes in Mashpee. And the idea being that if you get a substantial enough down payment on the house, that'll cut back on the mortgage. And then they can rent that out affordably to residents of the town. So, this has to go through the selectmen and town meeting, but the CPC in Mashpee did give it its blessing, so we'll see what will happen.
Right, and those funds are certainly limited to particular areas, and affordable housing is one of them for those CPC funds.
Right.
Let's talk about sharks. Most of the shark action doesn't seem to be in the Mashpee area of Cape Cod, Mashpee, Falmouth. When you think about sharks, we're thinking about the outer Cape and the lower Cape. What's going on in Mashpee?
Yeah, that's kind of the interesting point. Right. So on Wednesday, I went out with the harbor master of the town, and we went out through Ocoee Bay and in Nantucket Sound, and we put out, or I don't want to say we, he put out a yellow buoy that really tracks, basically tagged sharks. This is the first time this has happened in Mashpee. It's kind of a joint effort with the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy and the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. It's not new to them. They've been putting these yellow buoys up, up and down the East Coast for a while now. They've been tagging sharks in Chatham for about 5 years. They've tagged over 100, which is kind of fascinating. But when you think of Mashpee, you think of Falmouth, you don't think sharks. But potentially, maybe that's because it hasn't been studied that much. And so the harbor master in Mashpee is saying, well, if it's a problem in Chatham, are we going to start to see sharks? And we'd really like to know if there are sharks there. So they've put this beacon out. It picks up the ping of a shark, of a tag shark that's going by. His main point is, if there are no pings, that we detect, that's one thing. But, if we get a number of sharks, maybe we start to put together a plan to kind of address the issue. And we also talked to Greg Skomel. He's known around the State Department as the shark guy.
State biologist.
Yeah. He made a very interesting point in that, the ultimate goal here is coexistence. We know these sharks are here. They're potentially dangerous, and we have to learn how to, live with them. And these yellow buoys, that is, kind of the first step in kind of figuring out the habits of sharks and how we can live with them.
Mm. And of course, we're talking about white sharks, great white sharks. Most people refer to them as, not basking sharks, which there was a basking shark that we reported on earlier.
Yeah.
Which was huge, which was found, but they don't apparently have teeth, I've been told.
Well, white sharks are
white sharks
are terrifying.
Terrifying. All right, Sam Houghton in the Mashpee Enterprise, thanks very much. Let's go to the phone, where Sarah Brown is joining us from the Vineyard Gazette newsroom. Hello, Sarah.
Good morning.
Good morning. Big story on Martha's Vineyard this week with the departure of the hospital CEO, who mm-hmm. I believe made a statement making it very clear that he did not resign.
Yes. Yeah, this was a... as you said, a pretty big story here. Joseph Wooden, who's the CEO and president, or was the CEO and president of the Martha's Vineyard Hospital, as you said, he was fired, as he said, fairly abruptly on Monday morning. He had been on the job since last May, so just over a year, and the decision was met with a pretty decent amount of concern from the community. The stories on our website about this have garnered lots of comments. One has more than 100 comments. In part because of the way it happened, and also a little bit because of questions about why. And also, you know, this is the only hospital on the island, so it's a pretty important part of the community here. But what happened was a press release went out Monday morning from the hospital board of trustees chairman, Tim Sweet, that said that Mr. Wooden was stepping down, not really any information about the reason or when he would be leaving. But Mr. Wooden quickly, you know, told the Gazette that no, he didn't step down. He was fired, as he said, by the chairman of the board at 8 a.m. He said there was no notice, no discussion about what he'd done wrong. And he said he was asked to sign an agreement saying he was resigning for personal reasons, and he refused. Hmm. And, you know, he said he loved the job. He just bought a house here. I think what he said, he called it the worst of island politics, you know, and said he must have, you know, done something to upset the board or the board chairman in some way. He didn't know what it was. He hadn't had any performance reviews or, you know, heard any concerns. So I think it's fair to say he felt, you know, he said he was blindsided. And so the hospital board did call an emergency meeting Wednesday when they actually took a formal vote to terminate Mr. Wooden. So that hadn't happened yet. And it, apparently it was nearly unanimous, one dissenting vote among the 14 members that were there. And in an interview on Wednesday with the Gazette, the board chairman and the vice chairman said, you know, they didn't want to say too much. You know, there's the concerns about confidentiality, mm-hmm. but they felt there was this rift that was growing between Mr. Wooden and the board, that he lost the confidence of the board, which they said was, you know, was really hard to get back. They made it clear that there's no malfeasance, you know, that this was not anything that, you know, Mr. Wooden had done really wrong or anything, but just that there was a difference of opinion about authority. And they did also say that they were heartsick about the way it was handled, that there had been an expectation that, you know, he would maybe sign this document, and then he didn't. So there's just some discrepancy there. And so, you know, they did say that they felt bad about that.
How much does he get paid, and is there any information about compensation going forward?
That's unclear. We do not have information about the hospital board declined to specify the salary amount. He does have a 5-year contract, so that part is unclear, you know, how that will work out going forward.
Okay.
And they do, I should add, too, because, you know, we're going into the summer, that in the interim, the former hospital CEO who retired last year, Tim Walsh, he's returning to serve as the interim CEO while they search for a new president.
Okay, Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette. Thank you very much, Sarah.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Chris Lindahl is here from the Cape Cod Times, and we'll speak with Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Stay with us. And welcome back to the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran, your host, and with me is Chris Lindahl from the Cape Cod Times. Chris, big story about Cape Cod 5 Bank planning for a $45 million banking center in Hyannis.
This is a pretty major expansion for the Cape's largest bank. So this $45 million banking center is going to be on Iana Road, where the former Ethan Allen furniture store is, and right near one of the bank's current branches. The aim is to consolidate administrative operations that are currently spread across 4 sites across the Cape. And it's also going to allow them to, they'll be able to hire 90 additional people to house a total of 250 in this center. Most of the things that will be happening here are kind of behind the scenes. So you'll have technical people and customer service phone representatives. But the plans call for it's a pretty significant building, 2.5 stories, 78,000 square feet. And it's going to include a 3-story parking garage, which is the first of its kind on Cape Cod, and a rooftop solar array with over 1,000 solar panels.
Wow. So what's the process with something like this?
So because of its size, it will be going to the Cape Cod Commission for consideration. And if the commission does approve it, then it will go to the town for the traditional permitting process.
Okay. All right. We'll follow that story. We're ready for Tim Wood from the Cape Cod. Okay. Tim, you there?
I'm here, Sean. How are you?
Good. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joining us from the newsroom in Chatham. Tim, let's talk about there's a proposal in South Chatham regarding a National Historic District.
Yeah, in May at the annual town meeting, voters approved some community preservation funds to begin the process of determining if South Chatham is eligible for listing on the National Register as a historic district. Now, last Saturday, residents from the neighborhood gathered to hear details of the process from the town's historic commission and from Eric Dre, who's a historical consultant hired to help with this process. And right now, the exact boundaries of the district are a bit in flux, but basically it's going to run from Route 28, along Route 28 from about Cockle Cove Road to the Harwich Town line. Now, that area encompasses what's the core of the South Chatham neighborhood, which has really been around as a well-established area, a village, really since the early 1800s. There's about 110 buildings that have been preliminarily determined to be part within the district to be eligible, which means that they're 50 years or older. And have some kind of historical significance. At this meeting, most of the residents who were there, they favored the district. There was some concern about how it might limit use of their property or changes they might want to make to their homes if they're contributing structures. And, of course, here on Cape Cod, a National Historic District is overseen by both the local Historic District Commission and also the Cape Cod Commission, which has a little bit more teeth than in most areas. So at this point, the eligibility request for the South Chatham area has been submitted to the State Historical Commission, which makes that determination. If they give it the green light, there's a vote of residents in the neighborhood to determine if they want to move forward, and if that's positive, it goes to the National Park Service in Washington.
Okay. And another story, and actually this reminds me of what we were just talking about with Sam Houghton and Mashpee. Mashpee's looking to use some community preservation fund monies to put down some down payments on houses. But now in Harwich, they're looking at using those same types of funds for an affordable housing coordinator.
Yes, Harwich recently has recently completed a housing production plan. Actually, it's an update of a previous plan. And one of its recommendations is to hire a housing production coordinator. Town officials seem amenable to the idea, but they're wondering where the money's going to come from. And like you said, Sean, they talked this past Tuesday about possibly using community preservation funds to establish that position and have at least a part-time housing coordinator who can basically try to implement the plan, try to get more affordable housing units built in town. Now, they're talking also about perhaps sharing this position with another community. Chatham obviously would be the ideal town to share with. The two towns already share a director of the two housing authorities in the town. So that's something the selectmen are going to explore more in Harwich. The subject hasn't been officially broached in Chatham yet, but Harwich selectmen said they're going to take up that idea again at their June 19th meeting.
Okay. Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, thanks for filling us in.
Thank you, Sean.
Okay. Let's say hello again to Chris Lindahl from the Cape Cod Times. Chris, some investigative reporting. You got some numbers this week from the county here in Barnstable, taking a look at who has been dying from overdoses, opiate-related, opioid-related, whatever you prefer, overdoses.
Yeah, what we learned is that tradespeople, those are people who are carpenters, fishermen, waitstaff, cooks, people in those careers are overrepresented overrepresented among those who die of opioid overdoses. The data shows that between 2004 and 2014, 64% of overdoses were from people who are in those trades, even though those people only make up 50% of the population on Cape Cod. Mm. So the county says that they're going to use this information to steer prevention and treatment efforts. You know, one example is that they're holding a focus group in Chatham with fishermen that might be able to help in the county's efforts. And for our part, Casey Myers has requested a breakdown of this data. So we're hopefully going to learn a little bit more about what specific jobs are most affected by opiate addiction.
Sure. Would seem like that would be public data. And the theory is these are often jobs where there are more injuries. So perhaps they're being prescribed these drugs and then becoming addicted to them.
Absolutely. Definitely more susceptible to becoming addicted when you're being treated with opiates and can have some long-term effects when it comes to addiction.
Let's go to Jim DeRuda on the phone from the New Bedford Standard Times. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Sean.
Jim, I understand there was coverage of a few town meetings this week or within the past several days, Dartmouth, Lakeville, Acushnet, Fairhaven. What can you tell me? Can we wrap this up in a way?
Sure. First of all, there was a lot of high turnout at all these meetings, and a lot of probing questions from town meeting voters that looked to be a little more probing than previous years. I think people are realizing that turnout is important to government. So what we found in covering these four different town meetings this week in Lakeville and Dartmouth, both places they're moving forward with new police stations in cases that sick buildings with Legionnaires' disease and mold in the Dartmouth police station. They've been working out of trailers for 2 or 3 years. Now they're going to put millions into the first time they'll ever have their own purpose built police station in the town of Dartmouth. In Lakeville, They've found a way to send about $8 million toward plans to build a new police station there, where they still have the same problems of leaks and all. And the police department in Lakeville, even at the beginning of this century, because of budget issues, had to actually close between the hours at 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. for a short period of time until the town meeting voters got back and decided they would fund the police department. Over in Freetown, they decided to spend an extra $450,000 on their regional school with Lakeville, despite the finance committee and the selectmen's recommendation. And the town people passed it quite strongly to make sure more money would be going to the schools. In Acushnet, so about a month ago, Fairhaven Town Meeting approved the exploration of regionalizing with their neighbor, Acushnet. And as it is now, about a third of the students in the Fairhaven High School are Acushnet students, but they don't have a regionalization plan. Acushnet High School students go to and have a number of different choices where they can go. But at Acushnet Town Meeting, they just shot the whole thing down.
Wow.
They said, let's postpone this whole thing. And when someone on the school committee said, this is worthy of study, and a finance committee member countered with, I think, the quote of the day, we're not against studies, but a study should have been done prior to this study to make this study relevant.
Oh. That's quite a quote.
Yeah.
All right. Jim DeRuda, the New Bedford Standard Times, thank you very much for filling us in on what's been happening on the South Coast with the town meetings. Chris Lindahl is here from the Cape Cod Times. Chris, there's big news in a couple local folks who've been driving this issue of aid in dying, allowing physicians to prescribe life-ending medications to people who are suffering from disease and close to the end of life there. And so what did the judge say? What's happening?
Yeah, so excuse me, a Suffolk County judge has ruled that the lawsuit by these two men, both of whom happen to be physicians, but it's Dr. Roger Kliegler of Falmouth, who has stage 4 prostate cancer, and his physician, Dr. Alan Steinbeck of Woods Hole. The judge ruled that their lawsuit against the Attorney General and the Cape and Islands District Attorney can move ahead. The aim of this lawsuit is to prevent prosecutors from intervening in the case if Steinbeck were to prescribe Kliegler a dose of life-ending drugs, with the aim that Kliegler wants to kind of control when he dies rather than succumbing to his illness slowly. Mm.
And so the pushback on this is, well, it shouldn't be the courts that make this decision. If you want to change in the law, why don't you go to the legislature?
Yeah, District Attorney Michael O'Keefe says that it really should be left to the legislature to decide this type of issue. And Attorney General Maura Healey has also said similar things. But so far, the legislature has not taken up this issue.
Right. And so the doctors are saying, if I prescribe this, I could potentially go to jail. I could be charged with murder.
Yeah, in fact, O'Keefe said in October that that there really is state laws preventing this type of medical intervention, and the resulting charge would be murder.
Right. Okay, let's go to the phone. Joshua Balling is joining us from the Nantucket Enquirer and Mirror Newsroom. Hello, Josh.
Good morning.
Good morning to you, sir. And so you've been covering a rape trial on island. And last week, I think we talked about the conviction. Now we're talking about the sentencing.
The sentencing came down on Monday, and this is in the rape and kidnapping trial of a New York City man who was convicted about 2 weeks ago of three charges of rape and kidnapping in conjunction with a 2013 case in which he allegedly was found guilty of forcing a woman into his car who was walking along the bike path toward the beach and taking her to a parking lot and raping her. Jorge Adams Garcia, a 32-year-old Bronx, New York man, was sentenced in Barnstable Superior Court Monday to 15 to 18 years in state prison, followed by 10 years probation after his release, but court officials and law enforcement officials said that it's very likely that he'll be deported to his native country, the Dominican Republic, following his release from prison. This trial lasted about 4 days. The jury did find Adams Garcia not guilty on 7 of 10 charges in the case, but the three charges he was found guilty on do carry a fairly lengthy prison sentence for him to bring some closure to, for a number of people, to a case that had sort of captured the headlines and captivated Nantucket people in not such a good way for quite some time.
A horrific case. Let's talk about the interim fire chief. You have an interim fire chief after the permanent fire chief announced he's leaving the island, which was something of a surprise, I think.
It was definitely something of a surprise. The reasons not so much, but the suddenness of it definitely. Deputy Fire Chief Stephen Murphy, who's been with the department for nearly 30 years, was named the interim fire chief following the resignation of Fire Chief Paul Rude, who'd only been on the job for a little bit less than 2 years. Chief Rude cited difficulty in finding housing. He was notified that he would have to leaving his town-supplied housing at the end of the year, and the fact that his family was still on the mainland is his primary reasons for leaving. He said he really enjoyed the job, but those are just some challenges he couldn't overcome. Murphy has been in this position before. He's been an interim or an acting chief during the search for two previous fire chiefs, so he's well acquainted with the job, and that will be the case until a new fire chief is hired.
Okay, and big weekend on Saturday. You've got 112 graduating from Nantucket High School?
112 graduating from Nantucket High School. We've had the last couple of years over 100 students graduating from the high school, and the numbers keep going up. That'll be at the high school auditorium tomorrow, so rain or shine, the students and their families will be celebrating tomorrow. And Nantucket, well known for its generosity around graduation time. There's about $600,000 to $700,000 in scholarship money is expected to be handed out to the graduates from the class of 2017 and for alumni still in school right now.
Oh, that's fantastic. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Enquirer Mirror, thank you very much, Josh.
Thank you.
Chris Lindahl of the Cape Cod Times. Chris, let's talk about there was a fire, not this past weekend, the previous weekend in Provincetown, and displaced some residents, closed some businesses, and some reporting now on kind of what's happened since.
Yeah, the good news is that even though 40 restaurant employees were displaced by this fire, left without jobs. The community's really coming together to support them. They're all expected to be placed in new jobs, which is actually a result of the lack of foreign workers due to the delay in extending the H-2B visa program. So all these workers are expected to be put into new hospitality jobs. And Stephen Roderick, he is the treasurer of the Lower Cape Ambulance Association. He organized a GoFundMe.com campaign, which is getting a lot of traction. He's trying to raise money for fire equipment and some help for the employees. I checked this morning, and they were at $19,500, and they had a $17,000 goal, and that was donated by 199 people. So a lot of people coming together to try to help these people who were affected by a pretty significant fire.
Nice story there. Let's go to the phone. Ann Wood is joining us from the Provincetown Banner. Speaking of Provincetown, hello, Ann.
Speaking of Provincetown, yeah. Hi, Sean. Hi, Chris. How's it going?
It's going well. Of course, the talk of the town, or one of them anyway, there's lots of talk in Provincetown. CVS, the arrival, a potential arrival of a CVS. Not everyone's happy about that. What do you got?
So most people are not happy about CVS. It's applied to the Zoning Board of Appeals for a special permit under the town's formula business bylaw, which is a bylaw that the town created to keep chains out of Provincetown. But CVS wants to come in to the Riley Brothers T-shirt outlet building at 132 Bradford Street, and there's going to be a hearing on it on June 15th. Meanwhile, our associate editor, Ed Miller, talked to Outer Cape Health Services. Outer Cape Health Services is terrified that CVS will come to Provincetown.
Why?
Well, because it generates 50% of its revenue from prescriptions filled at its Provincetown pharmacy. It has filled more than 4,000 patients in 2016, and it relies on pharmacy revenues to support services like dentistry, mammography, and radiology, among other things that that it provides at a loss. Outer Cape Health Center is the only place that's going to have any doctors available in Provincetown starting next week also, because Provincetown Medical Group, which is run by Brian O'Malley and Will Sarita, are shutting down and they're retiring. So unless you basically, if there's emergency services you need particularly, Cape Cod Hospital is more than an hour away. So people who run Outer Cape Health Services are concerned that this could be especially detrimental to people with lower incomes too, because as a federally qualified health care center, Outer Cape Health Services can offer prescription drugs to the 340B drug pricing program, which provides drugs to eligible patients at really reduced prices.
So the concern is if they get driven out of business, then the drug prices for everyone are going, I mean, you're not going to have any other options.
Well, the concern is the only other place that has a pharmacy in Provincetown is at Stop and Shop. The concern is if CVS comes in and takes business away from Outer Cape Health Services, it might lose its dentistry program, it might lose mammography, it might lose radiology. It doesn't have enough winter patients to actually support the center year-round, so it could have a huge effect on services here on the Outer Cape, and since we're so remote, it would be detrimental to the community as well.
Okay, and CVS goes in front of the Zoning Board on June 15th for that waiver you mentioned.
That's right, next Thursday, so people should come out and say whether they're to or for it.
All right, we'll speak to you or your colleague next Friday. For or against, right. Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner, thank you.
Take care.
No, you too. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue to speak with Chris Lindahl from the Cape Cod Times. Lots more stories there. George Brennan will join us from the Martha's Vineyard Times. And welcome back to the local news roundup here on The Point on WCAI. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran. Chris Lindahl is here from the Cape Cod Times. Chris, they're going to be testing some turbines, at least the sound that comes from turbines. This is on the border between Bourne and Plymouth. Some residents have complained about impacts from the sound of those turbines. What's going on?
Yeah, these are the large wind turbines that many people are probably familiar with passing by on Route 25 on their way to the Cape. So the Plymouth Zoning Board of Appeals signed off on a set of testing protocols for the turbines that kind of aims to determine if they're too noisy. And that's exactly what many residents are saying they are. They're saying they compare the sound to a jet plane that's constantly passing overhead. And they say they've experienced lack of sleep, nausea, headaches, and they're pretty annoyed by this. Cranberry farmer who leases the land to Con Edison, the utility that runs these turbines, he says that they're no louder than a passing car or even crickets on a summer night. Hmm. So the testing protocols, they're being conducted by Tech Environmental in Illinois.
So the town is ordering the testing, but they're using protocols established by the state. Is that right?
Well, the state says that the testing protocols are in line with their guidelines, but right. The town is the permitting authority for these turbines, so the state doesn't really have much authority over kind of the daily operations of the turbines.
And it sounds like Plymouth is kind of reacting to its neighbor, Bourne, and with complaints coming from Bourne. It doesn't really have to react, but that was some of the debate, I think, earlier. When we first heard about these turbines.
Yeah, this is because they're right on the Bourne-Plymouth border. Like I said, right kind of in that stretch of Route 25, see some cranberry bogs on the side. So there's neighbors on either side of the border that are peeved by the noise that they say these turbines make.
And of course, if they find that they exceed state regulations, we don't know what happens then. I mean, look at the town of Falmouth. I think they shut one down for a while, and now it's still in the courts and still being debated.
Yeah, that's a big question mark. And one of the things that the residents who say these turbines are too noisy, they say that they don't have much faith that this process will accurately determine whether the turbines are causing excessive noise pollution, because the testing is being conducted kind of on a company on behalf of Con Edison.
I see. Okay, we'll continue to follow that as we get some results. George Brennan joining us from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, George.
Good morning, Sean.
George, your paper broke a story about a Tisbury police officer who found himself in trouble after leaving a prisoner in the cruiser for a period of time. I think it was 13 minutes, and there's continued to be fallout from that. Can you bring us up to speed?
That's right. This is police officer Mark Santon. And he is back on the force. There was an independent investigation done into his activity that night. That independent investigator found that he had lied on several occasions during his investigation about how long the woman was left in the police cruiser and various other aspects of the investigation. Despite that, the selectmen voted unanimously to reinstate him to the police force. It's contradictory to what you would read in this report, which is an exhaustive account of what happened that night. As folks may remember, there was a female prisoner. She was left in the cruiser outside the Edgartown jail. And when Officer Santon and a deputy sheriff arrived back at the cruiser to bring her in, she had wiggled out of one of her handcuffs, had a hooded sweatshirt on and wrapped that around her neck and in an apparent suicide attempt and had to be revived. She was successfully revived. But we also did a public records request for any other incidents involving Officer Santon and found that in 2015 he was also under investigation and was suspended for 2 days in a case where also his truthfulness was questioned by the police chief who did the investigation. So this is not a first time for Officer Santon.
Okay. Let's move on quickly to another story that you've been following with Assistant District Attorney Laura Marshard, who also is finding herself in some trouble. She's in front of the Board of Bar Overseers. That's the board that kind of has oversight on attorneys.
That's right, and this was back for the first time in a couple of weeks, back before the board for one day of testimony. But it was an interesting day because Liza Williamson, who is the clerk magistrate here in Dukes County, was before the board. And so this whole case boils down to whether is this a vendetta type of thing between Liza Williamson and a couple of attorneys versus Laura Marchard, or did Laura Marchard engage in prosecutorial misconduct? And that's what the board is trying to determine. Some of the testimony this week was very interesting, and the case will return on June 13th. No way to call this one yet. It's very interesting to see how it's proceeding.
Okay, George Brennan, the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you very much, George.
Thanks, Sean.
Chris Lindahl of the Cape Cod Times here. Chris, the plans are moving forward for a home for adults with autism, construction already set, and this is in the town of Dennis. And this is obviously a population that really has trouble sometimes finding places to live, particularly independently.
Yeah, officials and advocates say that this project is badly needed. What's being proposed is a 6,000-square-foot duplex with a total of 8 rooms, and that would provide, it's a group home for adults with autism and related developmental disabilities. It's called Forward at the Rock, located right near Dennis Village. It stands for Friends or Relatives with Autism and Related Disabilities. The State Department of Developmental Services last month put their support behind the project after organizers had kind of revamped their initial plan. They wanted to do a campus-style housing development, but the state does not support that type of development. So they kind of retuned their plans, and now the state says, this is great, go ahead, and they've actually put their support behind for a state grant for this project.
A board, the Seashore Advisory Board, that has some say in what happens in the National Seashore on the Outer Cape, of course. We had some stories a few weeks ago now that had been told to stop its work. People were very concerned what that meant coming out of the Trump administration. Now it seems like things are going to go back to normal.
Yeah, but still big questions remain about why exactly this advisory board and others like it across the country were ordered to shut down. The Trump administration said that they had ordered a review and evaluation of these types of advisory commissions as part of Trump's transition into the White House. And it was after a letter sent to Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke by Representative William Keating asking that the commission be allowed to continue its meetings that they're going to be allowed to restart again in September is the next time they'll meet.
And what are they looking at? What do they have to do?
So they've got quite a few things on their docket. They're looking at the Seashore's Green Park policy, designed to kind of find ways to make the park more environmentally friendly. Of course, look at endangered shorebird management plans, which is always something being considered on the Cape, and the planned relocation of the Herring Cove Beach parking lot.
We have two stories this week about birds, at least two stories, and one, actually both pretty disturbing. Some gannets are washing up. They're dying on Cape Cod beaches. Rescuers don't know why. And then another story out of Mashpee. They're investigating a couple deaths of some blue heron there. Beautiful birds, of course. Tell us about these stories.
Yeah, these are two different cases of striking birds being affected by unknown causes, causing them to die. First one, gannets. State environmental officials and other animal advocates are estimating that there's been 100 gannets affected by unknown causes. So they're washing up on shore, unable to hold their heads up, tremors, and unable to control their body movements. Wild Care in East Ham has been, they've been dealing with 21 in recent weeks, 21 birds.
So these are sick birds. Others have died. These are some that they're trying to.
Yeah, so 20. Back. So 16 of those 21 have died from whatever this might be. Officials think that one possible cause could be biotoxins created by algae, and those same toxins have been known to kill seals, sea lions, and even whales. That strong of a toxin.
Wow. Okay, let's talk about those blue heron in Mashpee.
Yeah, the blue heron, 4 blue heron in recent weeks have been found dead along the Mashpee River in the herring run, fish herring, and that's on tribal land. So Mashpee Wampanoag police are working with the town environmental department and the state environmental police to try to figure out exactly what's killing these birds, which are pretty rarely seen, although they have made a resurgence in recent decades.
Wow.
Talked with Wampanoag Police Chief Kevin Fry the other day, and he brought up one of the birds to the Tufts Animal Center, and they're planning on doing a necropsy on the bird to see if they might be able to determine a cause of death. And it should be noted that there's no obvious signs of how these birds died. They're just, no bullet holes, no kind of signs of disease or anything like that. One of the things, early, very kind of preliminary consideration, there officials are wondering if maybe it's the herring, the fish, that could be poisoning these birds in some way. Herring, of course, are illegal to take out of herring runs that you can find across the Cape. Although tribe members can eat these fish, and they do hunt them as part of Aboriginal fishing. And so the tribal police are asking anyone who might have been sickened by the herring to come forward and talk about it, so that might be able to help them out in their investigation.
Let's move over to the town of Sandwich, where there is a school, the Wing School, which town officials weren't quite sure what to do. It's an elementary school, I believe, and they didn't know what to do with that building because they're not using it for schooling anymore. But now there's an educational group, the Cape Cod Collaborative. They have an idea.
Yeah, this is one of the long-running questions in Sandwich of what to do with this old school. It's a really beautiful school, currently being used by the superintendent's office. So last year, town meeting did vote to turn over control of this school from the school committee to the selectmen, but town still had no idea what they were going to do with it. So Cape Cod Collaborative came in and has been talking with the school committee about relocating its Waypoint Academy. That's a alternative middle and high school that educates students that might have emotional or social issues and might have struggled in traditional public schools. Mm-hmm. So they're looking to sign a 36-month lease beginning this year, July 1st, to use part of the school. And they say that it would allow them to actually increase their educational offerings, talking about doing a community garden and working with Upper Cape Tech to do some more horticultural programs that Paul Hilton, the executive director of the Cape Cod Collaborative, says will really help, give some more opportunities to these students.
And so it's for 3 years, and I know Sandwich officials from your reporting there were saying, hey, this just gives us some time to figure out what to do with this building. It's only 3 years. We won't be making a bunch of money, but it will be occupied and there will be a lease. What about the idea of these students only being in this building for 3 years? Was there any discussion about how disruptive that might be for the students?
Not quite sure about how much they're considering that, but I do know that they're still in discussions about kind of what would be the best course of action, best way to execute this.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that the Waypoint Academy's current location, which is on Joint Base Cape Cod, that's a little tough for people to get to, especially because there's students coming as far as the islands and the Outer Cape to get to school. So just being a little closer off exit 2, it's a little more convenient and it shortens the commute.
Right. And of course, that lease could be extended. They're not talking about that now, but it's possible. We've got just a few seconds left, and a perennial discussion here on the Cape is the off-road, off-limits discussion. The off-road vehicles, the vehicles people driving on the beach sometimes are limited, particularly because of nesting birds. Plovers often.
Yeah, so piping plovers nesting on several of the Cape's beaches. So earlier this week, the gates officially shut at Nauset Beach, ending the off-road season for people who like to drive on the beach. And that's with the idea that this type of off-road activity can negatively impact the nesting shorebirds and disrupt their habitats.
So they do have some programs to help drivers along those particularly let's see, areas where they are nesting. They're known to nest, so we continue to follow that story. Let's say thank you to Chris Lindahl from the Cape Cod Times for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean.
And also let's thank our other guests. We spoke with Sam Houghton of the Mashpee Enterprise, Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times, Josh Balling, the Nantucket Inquirer Mirror, Ann Wood from the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Sean Corcoran. Thanks for listening.